प्रपन्न पारिजाताय
प्रपन्न पारिजाताय
तोत्र वेत्रैकपाणये ज्ञानमुद्राय कृष्णाय नीतामृतदुहे नमः। So today we start with the 8th chapter and quick recap of what happened in the 7th chapter. 7th chapter entitled Knowledge of the Absolute. In Sanskrit it is called as Jnana Vijnana Yoga. So there it was discussed. We started with the glories of the knowledge of Krishna. How an alternative way to become attached to Krishna is by hearing about him. And then the primary glory that was discussed was his energies, external, internal and marginal. And then how he is immanent as the essence of this world. And if he is all-pervading, how different people reciprocate with him differently. Some people completely reject him, some people surrender to him, some people surrender to some of his manifestations like the representations like the demigods or the Brahma Jyoti. And why this happens? Because of the Maya Shakti, and how by knowledge of Krishna one can go beyond the Maya Shakti. Now, just as in the 3rd chapter Krishna talked about Jnana Yoga, and again he talked about it in the 8th chapter, in the 5th chapter. So like that, similarly in the 6th chapter Krishna has talked about Ashtanga Yoga. And he has established how the highest among and all the yogis is his devotee. But still he has not done an explicit contrast. Like earlier, when he was talking about Karma Yoga and Jnana Yoga, initially Krishna told that Jnana Yoga, Karma Yoga is better for you. Even if Jnana Yoga is higher, still you practice Karma Yoga. And eventually he said, actually whatever result you can get from Jnana Yoga, you can get from Karma Yoga. You don't have to practice Jnana Yoga at all. So now, in this chapter what Krishna will do is, Krishna will talk about Ashtanga Yoga once again. But then he will show, so in the earlier analysis it was like, there's a hierarchy which Karma Yoga, Jnana Yoga, Ashtanga Yoga, Bhakti Yoga. Bhakti Yoga was the culmination. The 7th chapter Krishna said there's another way to fix the mind on him. That I will show. Now what he will do is, he will compare the two ways of fixing the mind on Krishna. One is through Ashtanga Yoga and the other is directly through Bhakti Yoga. And he will show how Bhakti Yoga is better. So in that sense, Bhakti Yoga is not only the highest among all the yogas, being the culmination of Ashtanga Yoga, but Bhakti Yoga is the easier way to attain that culmination directly. So in this way he will conclusively establish the superiority of Bhakti Yoga in this chapter. And it is with this purpose that remember ultimately underlying our Acharya described very interestingly that the purpose of Krishna to speak the Bhagavad Gita is to glorify Srimati Radharani. Radharani is not present anywhere in the Bhagavad Gita. You know, even Prabhupada's purport is not there. Then how is it? Actually, Radharani means Bhakti Devi. Is Bhakti. The purpose of Krishna speaking the Bhagavad Gita is to glorify Bhakti. So, that's why he talks all the other paths ultimately to show how Bhakti is superior. And that's why in 7th chapter 28 verse almost everything is over. But suddenly Krishna drops those mysterious sounding words, Adi Bhuta, Adi Yajna, Adi Daiva, to prompt Arjuna to ask the questions by which he will contrast and he will establish Bhakti to be supreme. So Arjuna starts the 8th chapter with the questions. So a quick overview which will make this clear. So those technical words which Krishna mentions, Arjuna asks questions, but Krishna finishes all those answers very briefly. He doesn't go much into the detail, and we will also just briefly discuss them. Then the main thing he focuses on is antakale chamami, how to remember at the time of death. And then he says about, first he talks about the importance of remembering at the time of death and the requirement of practice throughout one's life to remember at the time of death. Now what practice can one follow? Then he talks about two alternatives. So 9 to 13 is talking about yoga mishra bhakti. It is not exactly Ashtanga Yoga, it is Yoga Mishra Bhakti. And we'll discuss the difference when we come to it. And then I contrast that with Bhakti Yoga, Ananya Bhakti. And then to inspire a person further to actually fix the mind on Krishna, one thing is to show that Bhakti is superior Shuddha Bhakti, superior to Yoga Mishra Bhakti, while fixing the mind on Krishna. Another is, why to fix the mind on Krishna at all? Why not some other devata? Why not some other path? So then Krishna contrasts between all other fruits which are temporary and his worship which is eternal result. That's why he compares the material and spiritual worlds. And it's the first time Krishna talks a little more clearly about the spiritual world. And then, finally he talks about the departure. So, what is the consciousness, the frame of mind, the circumstances at the moment of departure? And there that he compares with that, with respect to the Yoga Mishra Bhakti, or the Ashtanga Yogi, so we will discuss this. They are very similar, Ashtanga Yogi and Yoga Mishra Bhakti, and the Bhakti Yogi. So let us start. Arjuna Vacha, Kim Tad Brahma Kim Adhyasma, Kim Karma Purushottama, Adibhutam Cha Kim Proktam, Adidaivam Kim Uchyate.
Arjuna inquired, Oh my Lord, O Supreme Person, what is Brahman? What is Brahman? What is self? What are today activities? What is this material manifestation? And what are the demigods? Please explain this to me.
He is asked one set of questions. How many questions have you asked over here? Brahma, Adhyatma? In this verse itself. So here he has asked four. Kim tad Brahma, kim Adhyatma, kim karma purushottama, adibhutam cha kim proktam, adidaivam kim uchyate. So five questions. In the next verse he will ask two more. Adhyagyam katham ko atra, dehesmin madhusudana, prayana kale cha katham, geyo se niyatatma bhi. So the last question will be elaborated by Krishna in a detailed way. Shri Bhagavan Vacha, Sharam Brahma Paramam, Swabhava Adhyatma Muchyate, Bhuta Bhavo Bhavakaro, Visarga Karma Sangitaha.
The Supreme Personality of Godhead says, the indestructible transcendental living entity is called Brahman, and its eternal nature is called Adhyatma. The self, action pertaining to the development of material bodies of the living entity is called karma or fruitive activity.
So here, this is one of the cryptic sections of the Gita, like the 13th chapter, and different acharyas have different understandings of what the term, say, Brahma refers to, what Adhyatma refers to. So, previous acharyas generally refer to Brahma, they say Brahma refers to the Supreme Lord over here. Because he is using Aksharam and Paramam, infallible, and Paramam is Supreme. So, this Aksharam is connected with the 15th chapter. Krishna is telling that Akshara, that Supreme Lord, is infallible. So, and he is also using the word Paramam. So, in that sense, it can refer to the Supreme Lord. And Jiva Goswami interestingly says that in this section, this Aksharam Brahma refers to Brahma Jyoti. And in the next verse, when Krishna will talk about Adhyagya and Adhidaiva, that refers to Paramatma. So, Krishna is telling that all of them are manifestations of me. So, Adhyagya and Adhidaiva, he says, refers to Paramatma. Now, Srila Prabhupada explains that Aksharam Brahma Paramam refers to the living entity. And as Prabhupada uses simple reasoning over there, he says, Aksharam refers to the infallible. Now, Prabhupada also says, Krishna also says that the living entities can also become infallible when they become liberated. As long as they are here, they are fallible. And Paramam can mean supreme. Paramam can also mean transcendental. So, the transcendental, indestructible living entity. That is Aksharam Brahma Paramam. And Prabhupada's explanation seems logical because the next is Swabhavo Adhyatma Muchyate. So now, generally we don't talk about the Lord Swabhav. We talk about the conditioned living entity Swabhav only. The Lord also has a Swabhav, but generally speaking, we talk more about the living entity's nature, and that's what is the context over here. If you see the previous verse, the previous chapter when it was going on, so Krishna is answering, Arjuna was asking, Krishna was mentioning about a soul, Jara Maran Mokshaya, Mam Ashritya Tantiye, Te Brahma Tadvidu Krishnam Adhyatmam Karma Chakhilam. So there the reference is to a living entity, soul who is taking shelter of the Lord. So now Adhyatmam, so here Adhi means in the context of or around Atma. So Atma can mean the soul. Atma can mean the body. You know, Atma can have multiple meanings. Atma can also mean the Paramatma. So, svabhavo adhyatma muchyate. That means that, so atma, if it refers, Vishwanatha Thakur says, it can refer either to the conditioned nature of the soul or it can refer to the pure nature of the soul. Svabhavo adhyatma muchyate. So, if it refers to the conditioned nature, then svabhav is what is our current conditioned svabhav. So then the atma refers to the body. So in the context of the body, the svabhav of the soul has. Svabhavo adhyatma muchyate. And if we consider svabhav to be referring to the pure nature of the soul, then atma here refers to paramatma. In the context of the paramatma, what is his nature? He's eternal servant, jivara sarupai krishna nityadas. So, svabhavo adhyatma muchyate. And another point here is that here Krishna uses the word, we use the word Trivida Klesha, Adhyatmik, Adi Bhautik, Adi Daivik. So Krishna will introduce these three terms again over here. So Adi Atmik, that what does that mean? When the soul is in the context of a body, the body refers to the gross body and subtle body, what are the miseries that come to him? So Adi Atmik, these are the miseries. And similarly we have Adi Bhautik and Adi Daivik. Adi Bhautik is basically, the body situation which the soul is in is called Adi Atma. And the social circumstantial context that he is in, the other living entities over there, the circumstances over there, that is called Adi Bhautik. And Bhuta Bhavodgarakara Visargaha Karma Sangitaha. So, Bhuta living entity, Bhav Udbhava, Udbhava means creation. So, Prabhupada says the creation of the bodies of the living entities. So that activity which leads to creation of the bodies of living entities is called as karma. Now the word karma has multiple meanings. You know, the word karma, we can use it to refer to the law of karma. You know, we often use the same word, and because of the context, we understand the meaning of the words. But the word karma has, in one sense, four meanings. So it's not very difficult to understand. One is that just the action that we do, you know. We should be very careful about the karma that we do. And we also use it, I am suffering because of my karma. There we are referring to karma means karmic reaction. And then we say that all of us are governed by karma. Here we are referring to karma as the law, as the system of action and reaction. And karma is also one category of action within the three categories of action. Karma, vikarma and akarma. So in this way there are four different meanings of the word karma. And here if you see bhuta bhavo udbhava kara visarga karma, that action which leads to the production of bodies. So in that sense, it's referring to karma in a generic sense. No, this means it includes karma and vikarma both. So, it's a very concise definition of karma. What is karma? That action which leads to the production of bodies. And in that sense, when Krishna uses a bhakti to call bhakti as a karma, because bhakti does not lead to the production of any material body. That sense it's a karma. And now, after describing this, this is a very technical section and we don't have the time nor the necessity to go deep into it, because even Krishna doesn't go too deep into it. So we could go much deeper into five different acharyas represented in different contexts. But suffice it to say that Krishna is telling that actually we have our nature, and that nature leads, when we act according to that nature, it leads to the production of bodies. Then he goes on to answer the next questions. Adibhutam Sharo Bhava Purushaschadi Daivatam Adiyagyam Mahame Vatra Dehe Deha Brutamvara.
Who based on the embodied being, the physical nature, which is constantly changing, is called Adibhut, a material manifestation. The universal form of the Lord, which includes all the demigods, like those of the sun and moon, is called Adidaiva. And I, the Supreme Lord, represented as the Super Soul in the heart of every embodied being, am called Adi Yajna, the Lord of Sacrifice.
So, Adibhutam Kshara Bhava. Kshara means change. So, the material nature, the Adibhut in which we are situated, is constantly changing. As Krishna talks about, Na Asato Vidyate Bhavo, of the non-existent, there is no endurance. Same thing. Kshara Bhava, Kshara, constant change. So, the Kshara is contrasted with the akshara in the previous verse. Aksharam brahma param adhivotam ksharo bhava. This is essential incompatibility of our existence, that we are eternal and we are in a world which is temporary. So, we can never be happy here, because it's like an ocean. one part of the ocean appears turbulent, we think, let me go to the other part of the ocean to be smooth. By the time I reach there, the turbulence also reached there. So, it's essential incompatibility. You know, when people get married, they want to have a compatible match. But actually, there's no compatible match possible because there is essential incompatibility in this world. You know, it's not that. So all that people can have in a marriage, as marriage bureau does some sort of matching, all that they can do is have minimum incompatibility. You cannot have compatibility in this world. Because that soul has a body with which that soul is incompatible. I have a body with which I am incompatible. And both of us are intrinsically in an incompatible situation and we try to find compatibility. It is not going to work. The only compatibility actually is between the soul and Krishna. So, Purushas cha Adhidaiva. So, Adhidaiva means, here is referring to the Adhidaiva, the Deva who is above all the Devas. Adhyakshena, we say, above, see from above. So, Adhidaiva means that Lord who is above all the Devatas. So, this refers to the to the Vishwarup of the Lord, in which he shows how all the living entities are his part and parcels. So Purushas Chahadidai. Purusha refers here to the Purusha Avataras. So in the Purusha of the Mahavishnu's body, all the universes are present. And similarly in the Vishwarup, all the Devatas are present. So the idea is, the essential point is that, yes, the Adhidaiva, there are different Devatas who are administering certain punishments, but they are all encompassed in one supreme being. He is the supreme Purusha. And Adhiyagyam Aham Evatra. So I am the Adhiyagya, he is telling clearly. So now there is some confusion sometimes, because a lot of yagyas in the Vedic culture are offered to Indra. So Prabhupada also mentioned in the purport. Who is the Adhiyagya? Is it Indra or is it Vishnu? So he is saying, it is I am clearly. Adhiyagyam Aham Evatra. So Dehe Deha Bhritamvara. So here also Krishna, while speaking all the technical stuff, he's referring to Arjuna in a very affectionate way. Deha Bhritamvara. Among all those who are embodied, you are the best. Because you are my devotee, because you are my friend, that he has mentioned earlier. And now he will focus on the next answer, which forms the crux, the essence of the full chapter.
Antakale Chamameva Smaran Muktva Kalevaram यह प्रयाति संभावम याति नास्ति अत्र संशयः.
So here from the context, Krishna is telling Arjuna that even if in a battle like Kshatriya, when he is fighting, he dies. If he is following my instruction, if he is remembering me, he will come back to me. And generally he is telling this principle, this is called the law of last thought. And whatever we think about at the last moment, that is what we attain eventually. And so that, Krishna first gives a specific spiritual application of that law, devotional application, and then next verse, he will give the general principle. And to reassure Arjuna, he says, Natra Samshayaha, there is no doubt about this. Because attaining the Supreme is a very difficult process, but Krishna is saying, just by remembering me, you'll be able to attain it. So, do I have no doubt about it? And then, is Krishna making some extraordinary promise? Krishna says, no, what I'm telling you is just an application of a universal principle. And he will tell that universal principle in the next verse.
Yam yam vapi smaran bhavam tajatyante kalevaram tam tam evaiti kaunteya sada tad bhava bhavitaha.
So general principle, and all the acharyas are practically speaking with the example of Bharat Maharaj over here. You know, although he was a great devotee, but because he remembered a deer at the time of death, he became a deer. He had to get a fawn's body. So a fawn is a baby deer. Now here, actually, Krishna, you see in his purports, Prabhupada repeatedly, almost 4 or 5 times in this section, Prabhupada quotes the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra in full. Not just chant the Hare Krishna Mantra, chant the mantra. Full Maha Mantra Prabhupada will say. And interestingly, Prabhupada quotes all these verses, from 8.5 onwards to 8.14, almost 10-11 verses, in the Bhishma Pitama section. there he in Prabhupada wrote the first canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. He did that in India. And India had very meager resources and no assistance. So that's why he does not quote any Sanskrit in the purports. Because to put Sanskrit in the purports requires a lot of typesetting and layout efforts. Okay. The verses can be put. So in the purport of the first canto, you have a lot of verses quoted, but only the English. And second canto onwards, we have Sanskrit also coming in the purports. So here Prabhupada quotes all the verses, their English translations, without the Sanskrit. So, tad bhava bhavitaha. That is the bhav. And accordingly, our subtle body is the template of our future gross body. In fact, in our subtle body gives us a glimpse of both our past and our future. By observing the kind of thoughts, desires we have in our subtle body, we can get an indication of what we were in the past. And we can also get an indication of where we are going in the future. And actually, when we, psychologists have found out something very interesting, that when a person is in great stress or fear, and generally, at that time, he thinks of that object, circumstance, event, activity in which he experienced the greatest relief or shelter in his life. So, a person might be a big macho man, a boxer, but he is in pain. You know, if he has remembered when his mother's lap, he was very safe. You know, he's in pain, mommy, he will call out. Yeah, why? Because he has his muscles, but when the pain is too much, you know, he remembers the time when he's experienced the greatest security. So that is the default tendency of the mind. The mind goes back to that situation, activity, event, relationship, where we have experienced the greatest shelter and security. And therefore, when we talk about the last moment, it is more active. It's not just a remembrance. It's not just utterance. Some people ask, if I just I'll remember God at the time of death, I'll enjoy throughout my life. Then when I'm fed up with my life, I'll put a pistol and I'll shoot and I'll say, Hare Krishna. So what will happen? Krishna will say, Antakale cha mameva, it is smaran muktva. You know, we may say Hare Krishna, it's unlikely we may not say also. But even if we say, we may not remember Krishna at all at that time. Because first of all, we cannot cheat Krishna, and not even on cheating Krishna, you know, we cannot even get beyond our own cultivated conditionings and tendencies. So, if a person is very attached to money, even when he comes to a temple, you know, he sees everything in terms of money. Oh, how much this must be costing? He doesn't see Krishna. Even when he sees the deity, he will think, oh, how much valuable is value that is put there? So, what happens is, actually, it's not just a question of one-time remembrance. It's a question of changing our attitude, changing our default thoughts. So generally speaking, if we want to see whether we are making advancement or not, then we have to see what are our default thoughts. That means when we have nothing to think about, where does our mind go to? And Krishna will use this in the later, in the 10th chapter, when it is, Machitta Madgataha Pranaha. So there, Prabhupada translated Machitta very beautifully, the thoughts of my devotees dwell in me. He doesn't say that my devotees think about me. Thoughts of my devotees dwell in me. And dwell means it's a home. So, Krishna becomes the inner home of a devotee. That means, what is the meaning of a home? That if a person has a home, he may go out for some work, but as soon as the work gets over, he comes back home. That means by default, he returns back home. So like that, a devotee may have to think of many other things, but by default, as soon as the other thinking is over, Krishna becomes his home and he returns back to Krishna. And Krishna talks about the same thing, Aniketaha Sthirmatir. While talking of the pure devotee in the 12th chapter, he says, Aniketaha, he has no home, but Sthiramatir, his consciousness is fixed. Where it is fixed? In my remembrance. So therefore, what has to be done is, we have to change our inner home, change our inner shelter. And we may not become pure devotees where we have no material desires. But if before the final moment comes, if we have experienced the greatest shelter of our life in the remembrance of Krishna, then our mind will go to Krishna. Our mind will go to Krishna. Now, of course, we know that Acharyas or Ramacharya's pastime is as Varadraj, where Lord Varadraj assures that even if you can't think of me, I will think of you. I'll come back. But then Krishna will come when we want him to come. You know, if we don't want him to come, if we have other priorities and desires, then it will be difficult. That's why Krishna will conclude this section by telling you have to practice throughout your life. Asmat sarveshu kaleshu ma manusmara yudhyacha mai arpita mano buddhe ma me vaishyasya samshaya.
Therefore, Arjuna, you should always think of me in the form of Krishna, and at the same time carry out your special duty of fighting with your activities dedicated to me, and your mind and intelligence fixed on me. You will attend me without doubt.
Sarveshu kaleshu, all times. This is a thing which will come repeatedly. Now, it's easy to practice devotional service for some time, but the real challenge is to make it consistent, constant. Mam anusmara. So here, Krishna has slowly shifted their priorities. You know, earlier he was telling, fight with detachment. But he says, fight with my remembrance. And now he has changed further, with my remembrance, fight. So now my remembrance has come first. Mam anusmara yudhyacha. Earlier it was, do your work and offer the fruits to me. That means working is first, offering the fruits is later. But here it is, remember me and do the work. So this is clearly bhakti yoga. We are talking about, say, mai sarvani karmani sanyasya adhyatma chetasa. In 3.30 you say, you do all your work and offer the fruits to me. So Vishwanath Thakur will tell that here, the remembrance may or may not be there when one is doing the work. But after doing the work, one remembers to offer the fruits to Krishna. So this is a lower level, he says. And he says the higher level is, one remembers Krishna and then does the work. Yes, I am doing this for Krishna. So here Krishna has shifted the priority, is going into the depth of bhakti over here. So he is putting priority to remembrance. By the same time, he is not rejecting activity. He says, yes, yet remember me and do the activity. So as sadhakas, for us, when we are doing our services, it is often difficult to remember Krishna. But generally speaking, I had asked this question to Janivasu. Janivasu was very kind to me. Answered a lot of questions in a very devotional way. Sometimes we need analytical, philosophical understanding. So I have certain Vaishnavas I go to. So whenever I want devotional perspectives, I go to him. So he was telling once that it is, Prabhupada also writes in one letter, as well as several places, he says, if we can get a service which we like to do, then we are very fortunate. We can do our bhakti very nicely. But then he also mentions that actually if we can do something which we like to do, then the great danger is that we think of ourselves as the doers. Because when we are doing something which we can't do well, we already know I am not the doer. I can't do it. So it's not just an internal sense, even external sense, I am not the doer, I am not able to do it. But when we are actually able to do a thing well, it is very easy to think that we are the doers. And then he said, therefore, and when we are doing the activity, it may be difficult to remember Krishna at that time. But what he told me is, at least before we start and after we end, we should remember Krishna. When we start a service, before we start, so we pray to Krishna, Krishna, I am doing this for you. And after the service gets over, we try to remember Krishna at that time. And then we can try to spiritualize our environment, maybe by having, if we are doing some physical work, we can have some kirtans or something like that going on, so that at least the background remembrance is there. So when the more we spiritually advance, this is theoretical for me, but I understand the concept. I'll give an example to illustrate what I'm saying. You know, imagine the first time an ordinary person sits in an airplane. So you get such a sense of elation. Now, how am I udna kehte, that's how the phrases come. That somebody goes thinking, oh, I've gone high up in the sky, looking at this airplane is so beautiful. I've become such a big person, now I'm flying in the airplane. So, you know, when Prabhupada first flew by airplane, they was from New York to Los Angeles, San Francisco. So Mukund Maharaj arranged for the tickets to Prabhupada. And when Prabhupada came out, what did Prabhupada say? Prabhupada said, you know, from high up, all the houses are looking so small, like matchsticks. And I was thinking, from this height, if they look so small, from Krishna's height, how small will they be? So Prabhupada, you know, he never got infatuated. Yeah, he used it for Krishna's service, but he was not at all infatuated. So for a pure devotee, you know, his internal purpose is more important than his external circumstances. And he may be going by a Jaladuta or he may be going by a plane. You know, how he is going is not as important as why he is going. Now, he is going to say Krishna's message. And Prabhupada was unaffected. Sometimes when he had to go, in India, when he had to go by preaching, he would have a comfortable car. Sometimes he would even go on a bullock car. Sometimes, you know, especially when within one city and he wanted to go to local places, there are times when Prabhupada traveled like that also. You know, when Prabhupada was in Vrindavan, he would come to Delhi and back by ordinary train. So, you know, for a pure devotee, certainly the awareness of the external circumstance is there. But that is not the focus. The internal purpose is the focus. And in that sense, the devotee can do all kinds of activities, but he is remembering Krishna. Because he understands, why am I here? I am here to speak about Krishna. I am here to serve Krishna. So, the example of this is Hanumanji. You know, we know he went to Lanka, right into the abode of Maya. And not just the kingdom of Maya, but the inner chambers of Ravana. But there also he was able to remember his purpose of serving Lord Ramchandra. And he was unaffected by that. So, you know, there is, in one sense, whenever we do anything, there is a peripheral awareness and there is a central awareness. I'll explain what this means. For example, now, if I am speaking. Now, my central awareness is what I am speaking to all of you. But my peripheral awareness is, okay, I am sitting on this chair, there is a window behind, and maybe some wind will come, and I may feel, all this is peripheral. So, you know, for us, in the initial stages of our bhakti, for the materialistic person, their material awareness is the only awareness. They don't have any spiritual awareness at all. So there is peripheral, central, all is material only. For a sadhaka, generally speaking, the material material reality, the material circumstances, are like the central awareness. And the spiritual aspects are the peripheral awareness. So, for example, in the first time, if some students wear dhoti kurta, then you know, yes, they are wearing for Krishna, but they know that Krishna connection is not at all there. Thinking, what are people thinking about me? How will people see me? What will people do? But sometimes in the first time, if we are traveling in a train, and if we are traveling with a group of devotees, and devotees start doing kirtan, and you know, if we are new, you know, what will be everybody say? So, what happens is that the world is more central awareness. And then, okay, if everybody, nobody is coming, shouting at me, nobody is beating me, okay, I'll also do kirtan. But then, as we become seasoned devotees, then what happens? Then the other people become a peripheral reality. And you know, we just want to have every opportunity to remember Krishna. So that becomes our central reality. So these examples are central awareness or central reality for us. So like that, for a sadhaka, the material circumstances are the are often the central reality and the center of his awareness, and the purpose why he is doing is in the periphery of his awareness. But gradually, as we keep practicing Krishna consciousness more and more and more, then what happens is that purpose comes to the center of our awareness and the circumstances become peripheral. And that is what Harishauri Prabhu writes in Transcendental Diary, that you know, he observed that whether Prabhupada was preaching to 1,000 people or to one person, you know, it was the same intense and concerned, because for him it was not 1 or 1,000, but it was serving and glorifying Krishna. So that was his central awareness. Of course, if a devotee, there are 1,000 people, the devotee is happy because so many people are receiving Krishna's message. And it is not that a devotee is unconcerned. Maybe some people are supposed to come for a program and nobody is coming. You know, a devotee will have the spirit. I'll keep preaching. Like Bhakti Vinod Thakur preached to the walls. But at the same time, we are also concerned about the material reality. Now, why did people not come? Did you not follow up? Did you not invite? Did you not do some sufficient promotion? That is okay. But for a devotee, that doesn't become a central reality. So, you know, when I started writing, so I had asked Jayadvait Maharaj, you know, how do we judge the success of our writing? Because when you preach, and you can see people, they are hearing, maybe some are appreciating, some are not appreciating, but at least you can see a response. And if you give regular classes, people become devotees. But when we write, you know, okay, there are articles go in different places, and some people read, who read, and who somebody, and it's very difficult to have a one-to-one correspondence between writing and somebody becoming a devotee by that. So I often compare writing to preaching, where there is a non-transparent curtain between the speaker and the audience. and the speaker doesn't know whether there's one person, 100% or no one, and whether they are awake or asleep or in whatever. You don't know anything practically speaking. So that's why, in a sense, writing requires more satoguna, because you can't see the results coming out immediately. So then I had asked, how do we know that, how do we judge the success of our writing? So Jayadrath Maharaj told me, Krishna is glorified, that is a success. So, I was so surprised that I answered it, and I didn't know what to say. Yes, Krishna is glorified. Then he saw my mentality. Then he told me, yes, actually if you get one feedback, you should know that there are 10 more people who have got similar thoughts, but they didn't take the trouble to write to you or correspond with you. So he gave a practical answer, but first he gave that answer at a spiritual perspective. So, you know, Prabhupada, when he was writing his books, he had no assurance in one sense that the books would even be published, or they would be distributed, or they would be read. But for Prabhupada, it was his mission to glorify Krishna. So in that sense, for a devotee, that is his central awareness. Central awareness is that Krishna should be glorified, that Krishna should be served, and that Mam Anusmara Yudhyacha. And to do this, Krishna is saying, Arjuna may say that, actually Yudha is not activity for bhakti. Yudha is fierce, war is going on. You know, when you have worship, you have to fold your hand, you have to bow down, you have to do all those activities which are devotion. Krishna says, no. You don't have to offer the body, you offer the mind and intelligence. Mai arpit mano buddhir. So, the same thing will come in the 12th chapter also. Mai arpit mano buddhir. And Krishna will say that, the character Adhishtha Sarabhuta on that verse he says. So, Prabhupada writes in the introduction of the Bhagavad Gita that the art of Krishna consciousness is the total absorption of mind and intelligence in Krishna. Because ultimately, you know, we are where our mind is. And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu gave that example to Rupa and Sanatana Goswami of a paramour. So woman who has a lover other than her husband, and he says her body is with her husband, but now her mind and heart is with her lover. So like that, for a devotee, his externals may be in the material world. So Krishna is telling Arjuna, yes, your body will be on the battlefield, but let your heart be with me. That doesn't mean you are inattentive while fighting, but you understand that you are fighting for a particular purpose. And that purpose is to please me, to serve me. So, mai arpita mano buddhir. And ultimately, why mano buddhir is important? Because bhakti is not so much a transformation of the gross body as a transformation of the subtle body. Yes, we transform the gross body, we may wear dhoti kurta and shirt pant, our hairstyle may change, but they are all meant for the purpose of changing our subtle body. So what has to be essentially offered to Krishna is our subtle body. Mai arpita mano buddhir. So manobuddhi is offered, manobuddhi is what is trying to offer, and the act of offering transcends the ego. So in that sense, the whole subtle body gets offered to Krishna. And Krishna says, if you do this, you will surely come to me. And then, how can this remembrance be cultivated? The Krishna will start with the next. There was a question, with an answer?
Abhyasa yoga yuktena chetasa nanya gamina paramam purusham divyam yati parthanu chintayan.
He who meditates on me as the supreme personality of Godhead, his mind constantly engaged in remembering me, undeviated from the path, he, O Partha, is sure to reach me.
So abhyasa yoga, Krishna is used to abhyasa in the 6th chapter also. Abhyasa in the kante vairagya chaturyate. So generally in Hindi, Marathi, abhyas means study. In Sanskrit, it means practice. So adhyayan means study. Abhyas means practice of anything. Abhyasa yoga yuktena. So by practice of yoga, what is that practice? Chetasa na anyagamina. One doesn't let the consciousness go anywhere else. And paramam purusham divyam yati. So by this, one will attain that supreme person. Anuchintayan. Anuchintayan means systematic contemplation. In the purport to the 7th verse of the Ishopanishad, Prabhupada Anupashyati, he mentions that to see systematically, Anuchintayan. Now there is a very interesting phenomena in the Bhagavad Gita where Krishna refers to himself in the third person sometimes. It's I, you and he. So I is the first person, you are the second person, he is the third person. So Krishna sometimes refers to himself in the third person. So Paramam Purusham Nivyam Yati Parthanu Chintan. You in this way you will attain the Supreme Person. Who is the Supreme Person? It's Krishna only. Then why is he referring to himself in the third person? For two reasons. First is that Krishna is talking about the super soul in certain situations. And at a subtle level, the super soul is different from Krishna. So because here, Krishna is talking about the yoga mishra bhakti. So by yoga mishra bhakti, if it doesn't become purified, they will not return back to Krishna. They will attain the super soul, and depending on their conceptions, either they will attain Shantaras and Vaikuntha, or they will merge in the Brahma Jyoti. So in that sense, Krishna is referring to himself in the third person to differentiate between himself and the super soul. And second reason is, Krishna also has humility. Mm-hmm. So because of his humility, he doesn't want to brag, surrender to me, surrender to me, surrender to me. You'll see this in the 18th chapter. We'll come to this once again. You know, Krishna, tam eva sharanam gacha sarva bhavena bharata. Tat prasadat param shantim sthanam praptu shashvatam. Krishna will say in 18.62, just four verses before. He says, surrender to that Supreme Lord and by His mercy, you will attain the Supreme Destination. And after that, Arjuna is confused. Now, what am I supposed to do? He's lost. Well, Krishna says, forget humility, you know, I want clarity first. So, Maam Ekam Sharanam Vraj. Not forget humility in that sense, but so Krishna wants the message to be clear. So, so that's why sometimes Krishna may refer to himself in the third person. And if you look at the context, it's one of those two reasons. So Krishna wants to establish the subtle difference between himself and super soul, or Krishna wants to show that he's not actually bragging. Krishna does talk about himself in about his supreme position, but that's just, he is God, so he has to talk about his supreme position. But Krishna's supreme position, when Krishna tells his supreme position, that doesn't mean that he is necessarily bragging. You know, if the situation demands that one has to tell the truth, then one has to tell the truth. No, if it's not required, if for example, if a person is just coming for a program, and the first thing he tells them, you know, I am the collector over here. It's not required over there. Now, if he tells, you may think he's proud. But suppose such a person has gone to a situation where there's a complete law and order chaos, and you know he has to make sure that he has a vision about how the police should act so that people will obey him. At that time, suppose he's in plain clothes and people don't recognize him, so he has to tell the policeman, I am the collector here, do this, do this, do this. So, you know, humility is important, but humility doesn't mean that we don't do the service that we are supposed to do. So if for the sake of the service, we are, now for example, now we have Sadhanath Maharaj now preaching all over the world. And then for that purpose, you know, he has to, if he's writing a book, he has to talk about himself. Who else will he talk about? You know, yes, he will talk about Prabhupada and Krishna when he gets the opportunity. But who will give him the opportunity unless they think of him as an important person? So humility is required. You know, when Prabhupada came to India, at that time, some of the Mataji disciples, he had sent them to Jaipur. And when they were in Jaipur, at that time, they would every day go to the Jaipur temple, Radha Govind, and they would sing bhajans for the, they had gone to get DTs for the American temples. They sing, and they were singing sweets, Hare Krishna Mahamantra Kirtans over there. And the local people got very impressed. These are western bodied, Mataji is wearing tilak and saris and singing so sweetly. So they asked, and they inquired and told about Prabhupada. And they were so pleased with their sincere devotion that they said, what can we do for you? Said, get Prabhupada over here. Arrange a program for this. Surely we'll do that. And then Prabhupada was very happy. And you know, see, our Mataji disciples, even women disciples can arrange big, big programs. And they arrange a big pandal sort of programs for 7 days. And when Prabhupada came there, and the Mataji came and showed the pamphlets. And Prabhupada says, this is Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada with his foreign disciples. So Prabhupada says, why foreign disciples? He says, with his American and European disciples. Now, we wonder why, you know, isn't this, why is this person so egoistic, you know? First of all, to say foreign disciples is not even foreign, cancel that, put American and European disciples. Why? Because this was an essential part of Prabhupada's strategy. Now, he knew that Indians are impressed by Americans and Europeans, and he had to emphasize that. So when people see Americans and Europeans, then what happens? They come. They come. Oh, who is the Swami who has just a disciple like that? So that's why the Prabhupada was very humble in the sense that Prabhupada did not want any credit for himself. You know, one time I think Brahmananda Prabhu says that Prabhupada's Vyas Puja was going on and they came to wash Prabhupada's feet. And he was washing Prabhupada's feet and Prabhupada's eyes were closed. And he was saying softly, you know, Krishna, just see how your dog is being worshipped. So, you know, this was Prabhupada's internal consciousness. He was saying, I'm just your dog. But at the same time, for the sake of preaching, you know, a preacher requires respectability, a preacher requires reputation. And therefore, Krishna, therefore a preacher may ask for that. You know, a preacher may ask for things to be done properly. Now when the speaker is supposed to go to class, we should introduce him very systematically. We should get the facts properly and then introduce him. Because the respect that the audience has determines how seriously they will take the message. So similarly, Krishna will talk about himself also sometimes, especially in the 10th chapter when he says, Arjuna, I will tell you my glories, but I will tell you only a fraction, because my glories are unlimited. So this would seem very egotistic. But actually Krishna is simply telling the fact over there, because he is the Supreme Lord. That's why he is telling that. But when that is not necessary, when he is referring to the Super Soul, or when that point is very clear, then Krishna may not refer to himself directly in the first person. He may refer to himself in the third person. And now, Krishna will start describing that Supreme Person. Kavim Puranam Manushasitaram Anoraniyam Samanusmarevya Sarvasya Dataram Achintarupam Aditya Varanam Tamasa Parastad.
One should meditate upon the Supreme Person as the one who knows everything, as he who is the oldest, who is the controller, who is smaller than the smallest, who is the maintainer of everything, who is beyond all material conception, who is inconceivable, and who is always a person. He is luminous like the sun, and he is transcendental beyond this material nature.
So, Kavim Puranam Anushasitaram. Puranam means the very ancient, primeval. Another meaning of the word Purana is Pura Apinava. It's old, but it's always new. So the scripture Purana is called as that way because although it is ancient, but still it is new. The Muslim preacher says, Puran ka matlab hai, jo Purana ho gaya hai. Chhod do usko bhi. That is a stupid misinterpretation. You know, that's completely wrong. Puran means that is ancient, but Pura Api Nava. It is, there are many meanings of the word Puran. One is this, that it is ancient, yet it is new. Why? Because the Puran is Smriti. Smriti means that literature which is heard, understood by the sages and explained according to the context for the easier assimilation by the audience. That's why it's new, because it's relevant eternally. And of course, another example, you learn Purayate Iti Purana, that which completes the Vedic message. So the Vedic message is not very clear just by the Vedas. It becomes complete through the Puranas. Now of course here Purana refers to the Supreme Lord who is Pura Api Nava. So he is the oldest, but he is eternally youthful, fresh and youthful. So I don't remember the exact figure now, but Krishna and Goswami literature describes that Krishna's eternal age is 15 years, 6 months, 3 and a half days. Something like that. That is his eternal age. What is the eternal age? Something like 14 years, 3 months or something. The eternal age. That means, in the spiritual world there is time, but time just creates dynamism so that there can be different leelas. Time, Krishna will define in the 10th chapter, 11th chapter as, Kalosmi lokakshay krit pravuddho. Lokakshay. Time is that which destroys. So time has two characteristics. It controls and it destroys in the material world. It controls. You know. We want to do something wonderful, but time is over. We can't do it. It controls and it destroys. So these two aspects of time are absent in the spiritual world. Time is there, but time doesn't control, time doesn't destroy. So if Krishna wants to perform Raslila, Krishna will say, time is over now, we have to go back. Now, Krishna will expand so that the whole Raslila can go on throughout the night. Time doesn't control and time doesn't destroy. So all of them are eternally of the same age in the spiritual world. So there are some gopas who are small children. They are eternally small children. There are the Nanda Mahayashoda Mai, they are middle-aged. They are eternally middle-aged. So in that sense, Krishna is eternally youthful. So, you know, there is in the this is a misunderstanding about God in the Christian tradition. In the Sistine Chapel. Sistine Chapel is a very massive church that was built in the medieval ages, during the time of the Renaissance. And Michelangelo was asked to draw a mural, a sculpture, a mural, a local painting of God on top. So when he had to draw that, what did he do? He said he had to draw God giving his grace to man. So you see, all of us have seen that picture, isn't it? Sunday feast, okay. How many have seen it? Let's show you. So, can you just remove the PowerPoint? So basically, so he started by depicting man, and he would depict man as a prototype, young, healthy person. And then after that, he had to depict God. And he started trying to depict, and he just couldn't find out any description in the Bible or any of the associated literature of how God looks like. And then he went and asked the local priest, and then he looked after a bishop, and he went right up to the Pope. And nobody had any idea of what God looks like. So finally he did his own speculative reasoning, and then this was what he drew. So this is even today there. And today it is there. So is the angle okay? Are you able to see it? Down more? Then you can pass it on. So this is what he showed. Now if you look at it, is so it's natural, you know, that it's very difficult to love a person who you don't know at all. So who looks more attractive? If you see, if you just change the angular tilt, it'll appear as if man is giving mercy to God. Basically, for the material logic, yes, God is the oldest person, so he'll be old. But material logic doesn't apply to God because he's beyond time. So, Kavim Puranam Anushasitaram. So, an old person may sometimes become powerless and nobody listens to him. But he's Anushasitaram. He's the controller. He's wise. He's wise because he's the oldest. He's the oldest, but he's still in control. And, you know, for him to be controlled, is he that he is very, very, he says, anorani ansamasvaredya. He's smaller than the smallest. So now, here is the contrast. He's smaller than the smallest. At the same time, sarvasya dhataram. He's sustaining everywhere. How is all this possible? Achindya rupam. So anoraniyam refers to the Paramatma in the heart. He's smaller than the smallest. Sarvasya dhataram refers to Mahavishnu. He is sustaining everyone. And on top of that, that same Lord who is smaller than the smallest as a super soul, who is larger than the largest as the Mahavishnu, that same Lord also appears in a medium-sized human-like form. How is that possible? That is Achintya Rupam. Aditya Varanam Tamasah Parastat. Aditya Varanam means that he has a effulgent white radiance coming from. That is the Brahma Yoti. So there are two kinds of blindness. There are two kinds of darkness. One is black darkness and other is white darkness. You know, what is it? Sometimes the room is very dark. We can't see anything. That is black darkness. But if in a dark road we are going and suddenly a vehicle comes with a big glare, there is whiteness, but that whiteness creates darkness. That whiteness does not lead to light. So, actually, in this material world, there is a black darkness of the covering of material nature. But if one goes beyond this material world, there is a white darkness of the Brahma Jyoti. And that's why the Vishwapanishad, the prayer is there. Hiranmayena Patrena Satyasya Apihitam Mukham. Please remove your coverance, which is actually blinding me. Ayatyavalam Tamasaha Parastad. So he's beyond the ignorance of this world. So now, why has Krishna told this verse? Because if you have to think of him, how do we think of him? There has to be some way to think about him. The previous verse, they systematically think about him. Anuchintayan. So this verse describes him so that Anuchintayan can be done. And how is that Anuchintayan to be done? He describes in the next verse now. Prayana kale manasa chalena bravar pranay. De pranam aveshya samyad satam param purusham.
Upayanti
divyam.
One who at the time of death fixes his life air between the eyebrows and by the strength of yoga with an undeviated mind engages himself in remembering the Supreme Lord in full devotion will certainly attain to the Supreme Personality.
Mm. This is describing the culmination of Ashtanga Yoga where the prana from whichever chakra, you know, many, some of you may know our chakra theory. Basically the idea is that we have the prana which is present. See, there are five different airs. Well, all the five different airs, they radiate in different directions. And all of them have a result, one position, they are like vectors. And the resultant is zero at one particular point. And that is said to be the center of the prana. So like when Krishna, it is a, when killed and delivered Yashoda, he suck out our life air. So actually the life air, Vedanta Sutra described that, when the soul leaves along with the subtle body and the life air also. So life air goes off. So what happens in the Ashtanga Yoga, that prana is lifted upwards. And like that, there are different chakras, and here is the Agya Chakra, the topmost chakra. So when the prana comes in the Agya Chakra, then the person is ready to become liberated. So then he can, by the power of his consciousness, just break his skull, and he goes out of the head. So generally when a yogi departs, if the soul departs from the area of the upper sides, you know, either by cracking the skull or from the outer upper holes, then it is said that he is going to go to the upper planets. If he departs from the lower holes, then he is going to the lower planets. So Krishna is saying, by this, prayana kale manasa chalena, bruvor madhi pranam aveshya samyak. So bring the life air in the Agya Chakra, in the middle of the bruvor. So earlier it was, fix the eyes in the bruvor. In the sixth chapter it was there. But now it is, bring the prana upwards. And how is it possible? Yoga balla. That is the practice of yoga. But what is essential in that is bhaktya yukto. So yoga is there, but the yoga has to be with bhakti. So without bhakti, it will not work. So here also Krishna is telling clearly that in even the sadhana stage of the yoga, bhakti has to be there. That's why this is called as yoga mishra bhakti. Now, Krishna Chakra describes that there is kevala bhakti and there is pradhani bhut bhakti. Pradhani bhut bhakti means that where some other element is extra. So we'll discuss this analysis in detail in the 9th chapter. But actually if the percentage of bhakti, literally is very analytical. Mm-hmm. If the percentage of bhakti is less than 50%, then it is said that he is Ashtanga Yogi doing bhakti. But if the percentage of bhakti is more than 50%, then he is a Yoga Mishra Bhakta. And if it's only bhakti, then he's an Ananya Bhakta. So if it's only yoga, then there is no result by that. Because yoga, the goal is samadhi. And one of the means to get samadhi is Ishwar Panidhana, surrender to Ishwar. So he says that without bhakti, no path can lead to success. So just yoga will not lead to success. At least there has to be yoga with bhakti. If it is yoga with bhakti or yoga mishra bhakti. So there are four things. There's only pure yoga, it will only lead to bodily benefits, no result. Then there is yoga primarily with some bhakti. That will lead to result of say Brahman or Paramatma realization. And there is primarily bhakti with some yoga in it. So, therefore yoga, then there is yoga with some bhakti, then there is yoga mishra bhakti and there is ananya bhakti. So that is less than 50%, more than 50%. So the primary, if it is yoga and secondarily it is bhakti, then it is yoga with bhakti. So with bhakti element, whereas it is more bhakti and less yoga than it is, then yoga mishra bhakti. So Krishna is talking here about yoga mishra bhakti. And then further describe, okay, how does one get the prana to that level? So then he describes the sadhana in the next verse. Yadaksharam veda vido vadanti shanti yad yatayo vitaragaha yadichanto brahmacharyam charanti tatte padam sangrahena pravakshe.
Persons who are learned in the Vedas, who utter Omkar and who are great sages in the renowned order, enter into Brahman. Desiring such a perfection, one practices celibacy. I shall now briefly explain to you this process by which one may attain salvation.
So sangrahena pravakshe, I will briefly describe it to you. We will discuss only two verses. But as to make it clear that Krishna is describing a particular process, Krishna says this. Sangrahena, summary I will describe it. So what are those two verses? सर्वद्वाराणि संयम्य मनोरुधि निरुद्ध च मूर्ध्नाध्यात्मना प्राणम् आस्थितं योगधारणम्।
The yogic situation is that of detachment from all sensual engagement, closing all the doors of the senses and fixing the mind on the heart and the life here at the top of the head. One establishes himself in yoga.
So this actually refers to sarva dwarani sanyamya, refers to pratyahar. You know, don't let any of the senses go outwards. And mano rudhi niruddhya. What does this refer to? This actually now, you know, if you see. Sometimes it's a little puzzling. Mora mana Vrindavan, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says. My mind is Vrindavan. And Prabhupada translates that my heart is Vrindavan. So what is the mind, what is the heart? Sometimes it's a little confusing. So first thing you have to be clear is, it's not the biological heart. You know, there is a conceptual heart and a biological heart. So biological heart is just the place where blood pressure takes place. But conceptual heart is the seat of emotions. So now, mano rudhi niruddhya means that what is the relationship between, so here Rudhi refers to the source and seat of emotions and consciousness. So actually the mind is said to be the door to the heart. It's like if here this room were closed, and then if there is a door over here, if the door is open, I can see outwards. The door is closed, I cannot see outwards. So like that, the mind is the door to the heart. That's why if we are sitting here and hearing the class, but if the mind is not there, the mind is somewhere else, and when will this class get over, it's getting tiresome now. Then what happens? The mind's door is closed. Then whatever is being spoken over, it doesn't enter. Why? Because the mind is the door to the heart. So that means the mind, when it is focused, it can allow the external stimuli to go inside. So what Krishna is telling? Mano rudhi niruddhya. So a simple example, say, this is the heart. This is the mind. And this is the external world. So, you remember earlier I talked about virtual reality, where a person is watching a movie. Then that particular TV screen, through which he goes into a virtual reality, that is like the mind. So now, through that screen, he sees the whole external world. Mano rudhi niruddhya means that the mind itself closes the outer door is closed, sarvadvarani sanyamya, and the mind turns inwards. That means one doesn't look anywhere else, one starts looking inwards only. So he starts searching for the super soul in the heart. And murdhya adhyatmana pranam asthito, when he's situated like that, yoga dharana. Dharana here refers to the seventh stage. Dhyan, dharana, and samadhi will soon come. Dharan, dhyan, and samadhi, correct. Okay, fine. Now, after that, he will describe how, if one can be situated in this way, and what does one have to do to get liberated? Om ityekaksharam brahma vyaharan mamanusmaran yah prayati tyajan deham sayati paramam gatim.
Being situated in this yoga practice and vibrating the sacred syllable Om, the supreme combination of greatness, if one thinks of the supreme personality of Godhead and fits his body, he'll certainly reach the spiritual
plan. Yes, he'll certainly reach. Now, so Om is not different from Krishna. Krishna told you in the 7th chapter, Pranavah Sarvavedeshu. So, but Krishna is also mentioning that he can chant Om, but Ma Manusmaran, he has to remember me. But still, it is Yoga Mishra Bhakti, because he is not describing that he will come to me. So here, the person can use Bhakti as a tool to attain Brahman also, or attain some other spiritual destination. So Ma Manusmaran, but what will he attain? Paramgati. So he will go to some other destination. So actually, even for a Brahman, we'll talk about Brahmavad later in 9th chapter. Even for an impersonalist to gain liberation, he has to think of Krishna. But he thinks of Krishna not as the ultimate object of devotion. He thinks of Krishna as a temporary object of devotion to transcend the material world. So Krishna is so kind, he accepts that also. So when it becomes offensive, that is what we'll discuss in 9th chapter. But here he's saying, they will remember me and they will attain the supreme destination. Now of course, it's a Yoga Mishra Bhakta. If he is fortunate, he gets purified, he will go to the spiritual world also. Or he can go to Brahman. But yet aksharam veda vidhavi, vishanti yajatayo vitaragaha, vishanti, Krishna talks about entering. So in that context, this can refer to Brahman, enter into Brahman. Now, after this, Krishna will say, this, So Arjuna starts thinking, it's quite complicated, you know. First bring the prana, I'm here in the battlefield with the, okay, well, how do I get the prana? Krishna does contrast that with other verse. And this is the only verse in the Bhagavad Gita which says this process is easy. Other places Krishna says it's fast, quick, I will help you. But it's the only place where Krishna uses the word sulabha. Ananya chetaha satatam yomam smarati nityasha asyaham sulabha partha nityayuktasya yogina. So Krishna is starting and emphasizing with the same point. Ananya chitta satatam nitya yuktasya yogina. So he is talking, nitya yuktasya refers to the external physical engagement. Ananya chitta refers to the internal absorption. So there has to be internal absorption, external engagement. Both are there. So labha partha, easily attained. And what happens when Krishna is attained? That he describes in the next verse now. Mamu petya punar janma dukkhalayama shashvatam napnuvanti mahatmanaha samsiddhim paramam gatah.
After attaining me, the great souls who are yogis and devotees never return to this material, to this temporary world, which is full of misery, because they have attained the highest perfection.
So often, when we quote this verse, the emphasis is dukkhale mashashvatam. But actually, if you see what Krishna is saying in the context, he is saying, they will not come to the dukkhale mashashvatam. The emphasis is what they will attain. Mahamutitya. They will attain that abode from which they will not come back to this world. So, the Vedic philosophy is not pessimistic. You know, it is. If there is any pessimism, it is initial, it is not final. And why is that initial pessimism necessary? Because it's like if a patient has got cancer, the doctor has to tell seriously, you have got cancer and then you will suffer like this, and then your hair will go away, then your digestive system will collapse, and then you will have fire like burning in your body, then you will get paralysis, then you will go blind. Stop, what are you doing? You know, I thought a doctor is supposed to make you comfortable. You are making me all the more miserable. So he says, sometimes people think that, you know, you have come to temple to be peaceful and calm and happy, and there we have bombarded, this world is such a place of misery. Boom, boom, boom. But actually, why it's told like that? Because the more the patient understands how serious the disease is, to the extent he understands the seriousness of the disease, to that extent he will take the treatment seriously. So the Vedic scriptures talk about the miseries of this world so that we will take the treatment of devotional service seriously. There is no perverse joy in just talking about the miseries of this world. The seriousness is there to make us serious. The serious analysis of the miseries of the material world is only to make us serious about practicing devotional service. Now, in the Western theology, there has all Western theology is primarily Christian theology. You know, Christianity had very little philosophy. They had theology. What is the difference between philosophy and theology? Theology is about God, and philosophy is about truth. So, philosophy is love, so force is truth. So, in the West, the Western philosophy was developed by many philosophers like Kant and Hegel and others. And they found the Bible was not very satisfactory, because there's not much philosophy in it. Just one God, and you have to surrender to that God. Moral codes were there. So that both Western philosophy and theology faced a problem. What is that problem? How to reconcile the goodness of God with the miserable nature of this world? And that is something which has been the greatest bane for Christianity. And because of an inability to explain this, people have, in the large number, have turned towards atheism. Now, why is this such a big problem? Because primarily Christianity, although there are references to reincarnation, they don't accept reincarnation. And without reincarnation, it's almost impossible. You know, if we to explain why certain babies are born deformed. You know, what wrong could they have possibly done? Why certain children, some of you know me about that Jewish rabbi, he wrote a book called When Good Things, Bad Things Happen to Good People. And what was his idea? He said that he had his own son who got parjiriya and he became old prematurely. So he said that actually how could God have allowed this? His conclusion was, actually God is good. He is all good, but he is not all powerful. Therefore, sometimes when suffering comes, it is against his will. Sometimes devil is all the more powerful. And therefore he says, even when we are faithful to God, and still we get suffering, we should learn to forgive God. So, to err is divine, to forgive is human. So, you know, what arrogance to say that we have to forgive God. But the whole idea is that they say, God is helpless, what can he do? They have very strange ideas to try to explain suffering. So other Christian theology says that actually, you know, if this, why did God allow suffering? Actually, God didn't allow. He says, God is in control of this world. No, God is not in control of this world. He says, devil is in control of this world. Satan is in control of this world. Why? Because when Adam picked that forbidden apple, and then he surrendered to Satan, so from that time, Satan has taken charge of this world. So Satan is going to cause suffering to you. And God is not responsible because you chose to be controlled by Satan. And they say, God is not in control of this world only. Then if God is not in control, what is the use of worshipping him? Yeah. So the whole idea is, at least you know, Islam also doesn't accept reincarnation. They say, actually suffering is because of a test. It is not because of our own misdeed, it is a test from Allah. Well, they say, test is fine. I agree, test is nice. But the problem is, suppose there is an exam. And every student gets a different question paper. And some students get an easy question paper, some students get a different question paper. So, exam is good, but why a different exam for different people? So, yes, you can say problems of this life are a test from Allah, but why do different people get different tests? So, whenever such a question is asked, whenever the philosophical question goes beyond a particular level, they have a standard answer. Shaitan ne tumhara dimag kharab kar diya hai. So, stop asking too many questions. So, they can't answer. So see, how it is, if you take a cricket match, simple example now. Suppose, if you have a cricket match going on between two teams, and one team starts with a score of 0, another team starts with a score of 300. Hey, why is it different? You know, the match is really right in the beginning. So, if we say that the goal of life is to become, if it's a material goal, to become wealthy, then some people are already born wealthy. So they start the match with 300 runs. And then others, you know, somehow we score one run. And by the end of your life, you don't go where they were at the beginning of the life. So it appears very discriminatory. And even if somebody says, the goal of life is not material advancement, it's spiritual advancement. But still it's a problem. Because according to these religions, their religion is the only way. Christianity is the only way or Islam is the only way. And we can clearly see that there is a difference. That some people are born in Christian families, some people are born in families which never know about Christianity, and some people are born in families which are averse to Christianity. So even if we say spiritual advancement is the goal, still the match is fixed. Because some people have already the opportunity for spiritual advancement, some people have no opportunity, and some people have hostility for spiritual advancement. So we see diversity, or we can call it iniquity means discrimination, both with respect to prospects for material advancement and for spiritual advancement. So, without accepting reincarnation, there is no way to explain it. See, if you see a match where one team is starting with 0, another team is starting with 300 runs. Now, we have three basic options. One is that the match is fixed by the organizers. Second is that it's just cruel chance. So now if we choose this way, if we have only these two options, you know, why is one person born wealthy and one person born poor? One is that it is divine, not will, it doesn't seem like divine caprice. It's God arbitrary decision. And the other is that it is mundane chance. Now, rather than have a God who can be so arbitrary and discriminatory, people feel it's better to be at the mercy of chance. So that's why if you have these two options, that either you choose a God who will do whatever he wants, completely arbitrarily, and there is no God. And you know, I say God is a fiction who is useless. God is, so what is the use of God? You know, he's not protecting us, he's not helping us, he's just arbitrarily imposing fiats on us. So now, if one team is starting with a score of 0, other team is starting with a score of 300, you know, it could be that it is a test match, in the previous innings they have scored 300. So, when once we bring in the previous life, the sufferings become very easy to understand. Why are we suffering? So basically, our suffering, it's not by chance, it is not by God. It is by our own deeds from the past life. So this understanding of the misery of this world is something which the Abrahamic religions have failed to explain to the world. And that's why people have chosen to atheism. And that's why Krishna consciousness presented properly, then all the thousands of people who became atheistic can come back to Krishna consciousness. Because ultimately people need some shelter. Atheism offers no shelter at all. No emotional shelter, no spiritual prospect. It offers only the idea that yes, we have rejected God. Some sort of devilish heroism people feel. Yeah, I have rejected God. But it doesn't offer any shelter. That's why we have to preach Krishna consciousness very vigorously. Now further, so in the Western history what happened? You know, the atheists were saying, see, you see this world, God has created it. It is so good. How can you say there is no God? God has provided rains, God has provided grains, God has provided heat, light, everything. And the atheists will say, can't you see there is so much wrong in this world? Now, if you say God provides rain, sometimes there are floods, sometimes there are droughts. You say God provides heat, sometimes it's too hot, sometimes it's too cold. So the atheists would point to the evidence of design, of order. And the atheists would point to the of disorder or suffering. And this debate was a deadlock. Because both are there in this world. There is suffering also and there is order also. So now the Vedic insight is there a place in this world where both order and suffering are present? Does the existence of order mean that there can be no suffering? Does the existence of suffering mean there can be no order? Or is there a place where both can be integrated? There are two places like that. One is a prison. That's why Durga Devi, Durga. Now, in the prison, everything is well ordered. And the prisoners get food on time, not get opulent food, but they get food on time. They also have their place to stay, they have the clothes, but it's all under suffering. So, you know, because in the Christian philosophy, the idea was not very clear. Their idea is that God, if you surrender to God, God will make this world into a sort of paradise. The kingdom of God will come to this world. So this was, so, you know, atheism says that this world is like a jungle. And the Abrahamic religion says this world is like our home. But both are wrong. If you try to say that God has designed this world to be a very happy place, it is not. So, but if you say there is no design, you can clearly see design. So this world is like a jail. So there is, jail is a place where there is order and suffering both. Now the, now, as I said, no analogy conveys the import completely. So jail analogy conveys that we did something wrong which we have to rectify to get out. The other analogy that is used to explain the nature of this world is that it is a hospital. A hospital analogy conveys that God is not the cause of our suffering. God is helping us to cure our suffering. In a hospital also, systematic order. You know, every single thing is recorded, every single medicine, there are so many complicated machines are there, but everybody is suffering there. But the doctor is trying to cure the suffering. So, these two examples, they help us to reconcile, if we just try to say there is design, 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 now there is so much suffering also. But if you say only suffering, suffering, what about the design? So both are integrated in these two examples of jail, which convey that we have to reform ourselves, and the hospital, which conveys that God is actually helping us to reform. God is not causing our suffering. God is not up there bringing the suffering on us. God is in here with us, helping us to face, to tolerate and transcend the suffering. So it's one thing to chant and dance and kirtan and say it's very nice. But actually when sufferings come, at that time our philosophical metal, our philosophical substance will be tasted. Of course our devotional taste will also be important. At least a philosophical conviction is required to understand the nature of this world. So, the suffering is there and we can't deny it. So, there is a very peculiar disease. It is called SIPA. SIPA means congenital insensitivity to pain with anhidrosis, CIPA. It's a very strange disease. And less than 0.1% of children have it. And those who get this disease, they don't live beyond 5 to 10 years. At the most, 25-30. So what happens, these children, insensitive to pain, they don't feel any pain only. So when the child is born, and the child starts growing, getting teeth. Now he'll just, you know, children put their mouth in it, they'll rip out their teeth. And blood will come here, but no tears will come and no expression on the face. And what they do is, they sometimes just rub their eyes and eyes become sore, eyes become bleeding. They don't understand it. They don't feel any pain. And if a Sipa child starts playing football, you know, the ball is going to a wall, the child will run fierce, boom, into the wall. Bang his head, he will start bleeding. And nothing. No pain. So there is no, first of all, the child doesn't feel pain. And anhydrosis means that they don't secrete water only. So they don't sweat, they don't get tears. And sometimes the child falls, the child, small baby falls from her bed, still no crying goes. The hand is fractured, but no crying. No pain. It's a... So Sipa parents, the Sipa parents, you know, the an American show, I think this, what is the famous show? Oprah Winfrey. That's TV show, Oprah Winfrey. So there they have shown the interview. In many places they have shown the Sipa children interviews. The parents, they have only one prayer, you know, let our child feel some pain. Why? Because pain is a protector. You know, when we get pain, we don't like the pain. But the pain saves us from doing things which would cause suffering to us, which would cause damage to us. So, you know, if in this tiny world, with our small experience, we can see how pain can be a protector, then we can understand how, from Krishna's point of view, the pain that is there in this world is a protection. Prabhupada gave the example of a fan. You know, when a child wants to put his hand in the fan, father says, no, I want to put. And what the father does? Makes the fan a little slow and then lets him put. He feels a little pain, it comes out. So the miseries of this world are given by Krishna so that we understand, hey, this is suffering, let me get out of here. So, you know, modern society does it with all its entertainment, with its, all its comfort and luxuries. It makes all of us into Sipa patients, where none of us realize the suffering nature of this world. And therefore there is no need to come out. To cover. People say, if God is there, He is happy there, I am happy here. Let us stay there, I stay here. But we are not happy here, and we can't stay happy here, even if we are right now. So, the pain of this world, Prabhupada writes in the Ishopishat purport, the miseries of this world indirectly serve to remind us of our incompatibility with matter. The miseries of this world indirectly serve. What do they serve indirectly? To remind us of our incompatibility with matter. Yes, we don't belong to this material world. So miseries of this world serve this very valuable purpose. See, this is, if I am prolonging this question, because it's a very important point, two more points I'll make. See, sometimes people ask, and if God really wanted to give us free will, then, you know, He could just have made another world where we could have been free and happy. You know, He says He has given us free will, but if we misuse the free will, we suffer. So where is the free will? Somebody may argue like that. If God really wanted to give us free will, He could have made us completely happy and separate from Him. But such a question neglects the nature of happiness. Actually, what is it that brings happiness? Now imagine if some person, you know, goes off into space and then blows a nuclear bomb all over the world. You know, now they have blown bombs in such a way that now they have made now chemical bombs. Because nuclear bombs, what happens? All the structures get destroyed. So now chemical bombs are made in such a way that it will destroy only the living beings and all the structures will be as it is. So the idea is that if Pakistan wants to conquer India, let's send a chemical bomb. So what will happen? All the buildings, all the infrastructure, all the equipment will be still there. There will be no Indians. So they have made weapons like that now. So the sadistic, the perverse intelligence works in many ways. And last time Janmashtami was there in Pune, they told us that they had huge security. They told now they have got a small mobile-sized bomb, it can throw germs which can kill people in 6 miles area. Small mobile size. It's a bomb, when it explodes, it doesn't send out fire. It throws out the germs. Or it throws out a poisonous gas. So, the point is that this can be very dangerous when human beings use their intelligence for tamasic purposes. But the point which I was making is, imagine if a person kills everybody else in this world so that the whole world is his. But can he be happy? No, because ultimately we want relationships. We want relationships. So if we say that Krishna should have made another world where I can be happy, happiness comes by relationships. And you know, we have already loved Krishna. We have already loved Krishna, who is having six opulences, all beauty, all strength, all wealth, all knowledge, all fame, all renunciation. So, such a Lord, after loving Him, now if we come to this world, we cannot be satisfied by loving anyone else. You know, if a young man is married to some woman who is like a film star, very attractive looking, and he divorces her and then he marries a 70-year-old woman. No, he has another woman, but he will not be happy with that. So, and like that, you know, after having loved Krishna, we cannot be happy by loving anyone else. So it is not Krishna's fault that he has not created a world separately where we can be happy. You know, for us to be happy, Krishna will have to create another person with the six opulences, whom we can love. But if he is the six opulences, then that will be the spiritual world. That will be Krishna. So it's not Krishna's fault. So Krishna, you know, by definition, we cannot be happy by loving anyone other than Supreme. By our very constitution. And by definition, there can be no substitute to Supreme. So therefore, after having tasted the love for Krishna once in the spiritual world, we cannot be happy with anyone else. Now somebody may say, then okay, if Krishna could not have made this world fully happy, then he could have made this world fully miserable. Fully miserable. Then what would have happened? At least we would have understood, yes, this world is miserable, we'll go back. But no. If Krishna had made this world fully miserable, we would have got used to the misery. Yeah, actually, if somebody is blind, you know, we people, when we see somebody blind, he says, Ande ko rasta de de bhai, we feel so much pity. But he's so used to it. And imagine if there was a village where everybody is blind. Nobody knows that blindness is there's something called blindness, and there is something called suffering because of blindness, because they get used to it. So if Krishna had made this world fully a place of misery, we have got used to that misery, we have lived in it, and we would never have even aspired for the spiritual world. So Krishna has given us the ideal blend of misery with occasional hopes of happiness. So what do the misery does? Misery reminds us that we don't belong here. And the hopes of happiness, they prompt us to try for something. And when we try for happiness in material life, and we don't get it, we start thinking, where will I get happiness? And then we turn towards Krishna. So the nature of this world is very perfectly orchestrated. So, the Dukkhalam Shashvatam is actually Krishna's mercy, so that we can return back to Him. Krishna says, if you come back to Me, you will never return back. Now of course, the pure devotees may return back. But for them, because they are in the association of Krishna, or in the instruction of Krishna, if they come as in Krishna's pastimes, they don't suffer. They don't experience Dukkhalam Shashvatam of this world. Now Krishna will, to emphasize the glory of the achievement of the pure devotees, He will contrast Maam Upetya, my attaining Me, with Dukkhalam Shashvatam. So, four verses talk about Dukkhalam Shashvatam, and the three verses after that talk about His abode, Maam Upetya. No, he is giving, and he first telling what it is that you will attain by remembering Me. Then after that he is telling that by remembering Me, what you attain, what is the glory of that? So he is talking about the glorious. First he is saying by directly remembering Me through bhakti, you will attain something far more easily than by yoganishtha path. But then by remembering Me, what you attain, how glorious it is. So inspire us. Now Krishna's purpose is what? To inspire us to practice bhakti. So one way to do this, to contrast it with yoga nishra. Another is, okay, whatever other paths you follow, whatever destinations you get, the destination you are getting by bhakti is far greater. Yeah, correct. Abrahma bhuvana loka punaravartina arjuna amapetya tu kaunteya punarjanma na vidyate. Yeah. So, Krishna is telling over here that even Brahma's abode is temporary. Now, there are two possibilities. One is that if this Brahma has attained his position of Brahma primarily by bhakti, with a little residue of material desires, then he will be Brahma. At the end of his life, he will go back to the spiritual world. But that's not necessary. If he has attained primarily by punya, with some amount of bhakti only, At Punya also one can either go to Brahma and be Brahma, or can go to Brahma Loka also and be an assistant of Brahma. Then such a person will be Punaravarti. No. So that's why that possibility is there. Although there is a possibility also for Brahma. So if you know, the universe is like a 14-floor building, in which 7 floors are above the ground and 7 floors are below the ground. So if you have to come out, the easiest way is come to the 7th floor and come out. Of course, otherwise, when the whole building is just burning, somebody will send a rescue helicopter and take you out. So that is how it happens in the Brahma Loka. When the whole universe will be destroyed at the end, at that time, Brahmaji is taken back. Yeah? Okay. Yes, that's what I said. So that's not what always happens. If you look at Prabhupada's purpose, other places he also says that Brahmaji can also fall back. So that is what can happen. As I said, two alternatives. If the person has become Brahma by his bhakti primarily, then from there he will go back to the spiritual world. But if he has become Brahma primarily by punya, with a little of bhakti has to be there, but bhakti is not primary, then he will come back. Yeah, but it depends ultimately on desires. No? So we see Brahmaji was attracted to his daughter also. So, it's ultimately, that's what will happen if he does his service properly. He will go back to the spiritual world. But that is not necessary. So that's what, ultimately it's not automatic. If one has become purified and qualified to go back to the spiritual world, one will go back. But if one is not purified and qualified, one will not go back. So these are, whenever we read anything, you know, we always have to, like now the GBC has formed the Prabhupada Hermeneutics Committee. Hermeneutics means, it is the art of understanding scripture. So the basic principle of the hermeneutics is, the committee recommendation is that, you know, whenever we take any statement of Srila Prabhupada, we have to see what Prabhupada has said about that topic in throughout his works. We cannot take one statement of Prabhupada and absolutize it. We have to see the different statements of Prabhupada and then we have to arrive at a conclusion understanding. So that is a possibility. But that is not a universal necessity. It may happen, it may not happen. That's why Krishna is telling you sometimes they may fall back also. Now he will discuss. Somebody may say, actually Brahma, isn't he a great god? He's one of the three great devatas, and how can you say that from there he will fall back? Krishna explains that because he is not eternal. His life is also temporary. That he describes it as lifespan. Sahasra yuga paryantam aharyat brahmano vidho ratrim yuga sahasrantam deho ratra vidho janaha. Next one. Avyakta vyaktaya sarva prabhavantyah ragame ratryagame praliyante tatraiva vyakta samyake.
At the beginning of Brahma state, all living entities become manifest from unmanifest state, and thereafter, when the night falls, they are merged into unmanifest state.
So, we know that what happens is that when Brahmaji sleeps, at that time, the lower 11 planetary systems are destroyed, and some of the lokas, they go to some of the higher planetary beings, they go to the upper three planets, and they reside over there, and everything is in an unmanifest, inactive stage. And then, when he wakes up again, he creates everything. And that's how it happens. Now, Krishna will tell, in the next verse, the general principle. Bhuta grama saivayam bhutva bhutva praliyate shapartha prabhavatya haragame.
Again and again, when Brahma arrives, all living entities come to being, and with the arrival of Brahma night, they are helplessly
annihilated. Nobody wants to die, but just helplessly. And you can see in this world also, when floods come, droughts come, people are just helpless. So completely just devastated away. So now, after giving this very sobering picture, Krishna will contrast this with another world where there is no destruction like that. Parastasmat bhavonyo vyakto vyakta sanatanah yasa sarveshu bhuteshu nashyatsu na vinashyati.
There is another unmanifest nature, which is eternal and is transcendental.
So now, sometimes, same words may have different meanings. So, vyakto vyakta sanatanaha. So now, the word unmanifest can refer to matter in an unmanifest stage, as it is at the night of Brahma, or it can refer to the spiritual nature which is unmanifest to the material senses. And that will become clear. So Krishna is referring to the second meaning of unmanifest. That's why I think that is, that abode is beyond the manifest and unmanifest. And if it is not clear, so here the word tu, isn't it? Prasasmat tu bhavan. Tu refers to differentiation, but. And Krishna will again use the word avyakta in the next verse. But he says avyakta refers to not the material unmanifest, but refers to spiritual. Avyakta ksharityuktas tamahu paramam gatim yam praptena nivartante tadhama paramam mama.
That reach, the Vedanta describes as unmanifest and infallible. That reach is known as the supreme destination, the place from which, having attended it, one never returns. That is my supreme abode.
So, he is talking, Vijayadasi, you will attain that supreme destination, my abode. So he'll attain that supreme destination, but that supreme destination is my abode. Krishna makes it very clear once again now. And then he will describe how that abode is to be attained more explicitly once again. Bhaktya tvananyaya, purushasya para partha, bhaktya labhya tvananyaya, yasyanta sthani bhutani, yena sarvam idam tatam.
The supreme personality of Godhead, who is greater than all, is attainable by unalloyed devotion.
So again Krishna third person reference. Saddham parama purusha sa para partha. So he has described two things. Again what you have described earlier. Yasyantah sthani bhutani. The whole world is within him. Sarvasya dhataram. Yena sarvamidam datam. So the whole world is within him as Mahavishnu. And he is pervading through the whole universe as Shiva Daksha Vishnu. As the super soul is present everywhere. And now, after describing this, Krishna will elaborate further on the final moment. So Krishna is alternating between two themes over here. His remembrance and the moment of death. So, earlier he talked about how he had to do so many things to prepare for the final moment of death. So, you have to practice brahmacharya, one has to get the raise the prana, all those things. As compared to that, just remember me. That's one way. So that he contrasted the preparation for the last moment earlier. So there have been basically three contrasts happening. First is the preparation for the remembrance at the last moment, and then the result of remembering him versus remembering something else. And now third is the remembrance at the last moment. Actually, remembering at the last moment, what all one has to do by the path of Yoga Mishra Bhakti, by the other paths, and what one has to do by Bhakti path. Yatra kale tvanavrittim avrittim chaiva yoginaha prayatayantitam kalam pakshami bharatarshabha.
O best of Bharatas, I shall now explain to you the different times at which passing away from this world the yogi does or does not come back.
So two possibilities he is going to tell, so I will tell you this. So now he describes kala. Now we will see the time, but it is not just time. Because if you see what the list that Krishna will describe, it will have elements apart from the time also. We'll discuss what it means. Agnir jyotirah shukla shanmasa vittarayanam yakrayata gacchanti brahma brahma vidojanah.
Those who know the supreme Brahman attain that supreme by passing away from the world. There is the influence of the Hari God in the light at an auspicious moment of the day during the fourth night of extreme moon. Or during the
6 months
when the sun
travels in the north. So in the Upanishads there's a description. So here Krishna, as I said, is talking about the kala. Kala refers to time. But then he's talking about agni, jyoti. So he's talking about light and fire and so many things he's talking about. Now fire and light, if it is okay, if it's Surya, that's okay because it's daytime. But agni itself, it does not directly correlate with the time. So what does it actually mean? So in the Upanishads, it is described as the journey, the post-mortem journey of the soul. Post-mortem means after death. The post-mortem journey of the soul is guided by certain devatas. They are called the Ativahik devatas. Vahak, Vahik is to travel, Vahan. Ativahik, those who help the soul travel beyond this death. and Krishna, there are 21 devatas like that. So Krishna is giving a partial list. So here, so each of these, Uttarayan is a particular devata in charge of that. Agni is a particular devata in charge of that. Jyoti, Shukla. So all these are, Krishna is talking about the devatas in charge of that. So if one has to go to Brahma, Brahma, Brahma Vyojana, then not only is the precise time required, but at that precise time, the blessings and the guidance of all these Ativahik devatas are required. Then one will be able to attain that. And then Krishna will contrast that. So this section is also taken by Baldev Vidya Bhushan in a metaphorical way. Metaphorical way means, he says that there is a path of darkness and the path of light. So he says, the path of darkness will lead to continuation of material existence. So he says, path of darkness refers to karma kand. That we'll talk about next verse. Path of light refers to jnana kand, which will take one to Brahman. So it is the path of light, but still it doesn't lead to the ultimate destination. So Brahma, Brahma Vidojana refers to those yogis who will attain the Brahman. So if they depart in this time, then they will attain Brahman. In this time, with the blessings of all these devatas, they will attain Brahman. So in one sense, tamasoma jyotirgama. So jyoti refers to the Brahman and the spiritual world with all the spiritual planets within it. Or rather, spiritual planet includes both the Brahman and spiritual world. Includes both the Brahman and the spiritual planets. So everything is Jyotirmay. So it is the path of light. Correct.
But where it is in
this verse? It will come in the last two verses. Supremacy of pure devotion. Here basically what Krishna is doing, he's talking, as I said, the preparation for remembering at the last moment, the glory of remembering Krishna, and now the last moment itself. So Krishna is comparing bhakti and other paths. So bhakti offers us greater ease in preparing for the last moment. Bhakti offers a more glorious result if we succeed. And at the last moment, bhakti is the easiest. So now Krishna is glorifying bhakti by saying how at the last moment bhakti offers us the easiest way. Dhumo ratris tatha Krishna shanmasa dakshinayanam tatha payatava samjyotir yogi praptya nivartate chandrama samjyotir.
It passes away from this world when the smoke, the night, the fourth night of waning moon, or the sixth month when the sun passes the south.
So he will go Chandrama Samjyotir. He will go to higher planets. Chandra, Swarga is the moon is compared to one of the heavenly planets. He will go there, but he will come back. This is referring to the part of Karma Kand. So one will, the unsuccessful also, this can be understood at different levels. One is that, even in the part of Ashtanga Yoga or Yoga Mishra Bhakti, you know, if one departs at the right moment, one will attain Brahman. Otherwise, the wrong moment, one will come back to the material world. We'll go to heaven, partial success, but come back. So this is the understanding that Prabhupada gives us. Now Baldev Vidya Bhushan takes this whole thing at a metaphorical level. One is the path of light, the path of darkness. But bhakti is greater than both. Because the path of darkness keeps us in the dark material world. Path of light takes us to the Brahman, but it doesn't reveal us the source of that light. And then Krishna will tell, don't worry Arjuna. Arjuna starts thinking, in this battlefield, is this an Uttarayana or Dakshinayana? What I will, if I die, don't worry Arjuna about all this. Naite Sruti Partha Janam Shukla Krishna Gati Yate Jagata Shashvate Mate Ekaya Yatyana Vrittim Anyaya Vartate Punha.
According to Vedic opinion, there are two ways of passing from this world, one in light and one in darkness. When one passes in light, he does not come back, but when one passes in darkness, he returns.
Yes. So here Krishna is summarizing what he spoke, and the verse I was referring to is the next verse. Naite sruti partha janan yogi muhiyati kashchana tasmat sarveshu kaleshu yoga yukto bhava arjuna.
Although the devotees know these two paths, O Arjuna, they are never bewildered, therefore be always fixed in devotion.
Yes, tasmat sarveshu kaleshu. Earlier I said mamanusmadhyaja. So same thing is saying yoga yukto bhava arjuna. So what is that yoga yukta? That is mahamanuspara only. And now he will tell, therefore he will reassure Arjuna, because if you die as my devotee while remembering me, what will you attain? He will tell that, okay, there are these two paths with these reasons, but whatever is available on these paths, you will get that and much more. Vedeshu yageshu tapahasu chaiva daneshu yat punya phalam pradishtam atyeti tat sarvam idam viditva yogi param sthanam upaiti chadyam.
A person who accepts the path of devotional service is not bereft of the results derived from studying the Vedas, performing sacrifices, undergoing austerities, giving charity or pursuing philosophical and spiritual activities. Simply by performing devotional service, he attains all these. And at the end, he reaches the supreme eternal abode.
Idam viditva. If you understand this, Arjuna, what will happen? You will get all this Vedeshu, Yajneshu, Tapasu, Chaiva, Daneshu. So, Yajna, Dana and Tapa. These are three primary activities you talked about in the Vedas. And so, whatever result comes by that, Arjuna, you will get it all and much more. And Prabhupada's purport is very beautiful. Prabhupada essentially said that Krishna consciousness is success in one stroke. One stroke we get all the results of all the other parts. That is the summary of Prabhupada's purport. So here Krishna's heart is now, what is closest to his heart, he started speaking that now. Seventh chapter, he introduced, he talked about his own glories to talk about bhakti. He has talked about how different people reciprocate differently. Then after talking about that, he started talking about bhakti more, glorifying bhakti as compared to yoga. And now, the ninth chapter will be a sort of emotional climax. Like Krishna will talk, all the 10 chapters called 12 chapters called Bhakti Yoga, but actually Krishna's intense devotional emotions come out, they peak in the course of the Bhagavad Gita in the 9th chapter, and then at the end in the 18th chapter. So in the 9th chapter Krishna will wholeheartedly glorify devotional service and inspire Arjuna to practice it irrespective of all deficiencies that might be there. So thank you very much. श्रीमद् भगवद गीता की जय प्रभुपाद की
जय
गौर भक्त वृंद की जय इताई गौर प्रेमानंदे हरि बोल प्रभुपाद की जय. So yesterday I had gone one around 15 minutes over time, so I finished 15 minutes before today.